That's weird. That's what happens then too, yeah. It's like it's backwards.
Okay. I'm Cynthia Harper. I'm from the University of California, San Francisco. And today I'm going to be presenting some results on contraceptive counseling and care for HIV-infected and at-risk women in South Africa. An international team has been working on this study, and the results I'm presenting today have been in collaboration with IBIS Reproductive Health in Cambridge and Johannesburg, and the South African Medical Research Council in Durban. And we have a large team of investigators up here to whom I'm very grateful, and also managers of the project, and we were funded by NICHD. Unmet need for contraception is high in sub-Saharan Africa, and in South Africa in particular, almost half of pregnancies are unintended. The rates of unintended pregnancy are higher among the young, the poor, the less educated women, as are rates of HIV infection. HIV prevalence among women of childbearing age in South Africa is around 30%. And the rates among women ages 20 to 29 are almost four times higher than the rates among men. The vertical transmission of HIV infection is associated with maternal morbidity and adverse pregnancy outcomes, and also vertical transmission of HIV is at about 30% now in South Africa because of limited distribution of ART. Although hopefully with this new change in leadership and a new Minister of Health, we might see more widespread ART as needed. But the public health need to prevent unintended pregnancy in this context is very important, very high. A striking point about contraception in South Africa, as shown in the DHS surveys, is that almost all women, 97%, have heard of a modern method of contraception, and most have tried it. 85% of married women have ever used it. Injectables are common, with a prevalence of 23%, but they require regular visits to healthcare clinics and have disappointing continuation rates in South Africa as well as in some other countries. Oral contraceptives also account for hormonal contraceptive use in South Africa, and about 11% of current use. And they require resupplies at regular intervals too, and are user-dependent, which often means missed pills. Use of long-acting reversible contraception is negligible. IUD use is very similar to that in the U.S. It's 1.8% in South Africa, and it's used very much as it's used here, as a niche method for a very limited set of women at the upper ages and of childbearing. Male condom use is low in South Africa, particularly within marriage, and dual method use is low as well. The objectives of our study was to assess prevention practices of healthcare providers in a high HIV setting. How are they serving women's contraceptive needs? What's their approach to combining pregnancy and HIV-STI prevention? What condom messages do they give to their female patients in this context of low male condom use? The data we analyzed here are from South Africa, but we also conducted the study in the neighboring country of Zimbabwe, as well as in the United States, where women have widely divergent disease risks and fertility intentions. In total in the study, we have 91 in-depth interviews with healthcare providers, and we've also been conducting national probability surveys in providers in these same countries. And for this presentation, we analyzed data from 30 in-depth interviews from South Africa of physicians and nurses. Here, I'm putting all of the approvals up here to show that it's an intensive process to work in, I think, any country in sub-Saharan Africa, but in South Africa in particular, there's a lot of controversy about research like this, and there have been a lot of results that have come out in recent years that have made people worried about this research. And so we had a pretty serious process with approvals for recruiting, from IRB approvals to the community involvement with protocol advisory boards. And then the approvals for recruiting providers, we needed approval at every single level. You would just move one little bit and more approvals. And what it means for the study is that it was a very top-down recruitment process of providers, and we're probably seeing results. It's one of the limitations from the more experienced providers who know a little more, because we really had to go straight from the National Department of Health and through all the people in charge to recruit our participants. So we have a purposive sample of providers who work in HIV prevention then and family planning, and they had to have seen at least 20 patients for family planning or HIV STI services per week to be interviewed. We conducted our interviews in three very different regions, KwaZulu-Natal, Gauteng, and Western Cape. And KwaZulu-Natal is a province with the highest HIV prevalence in South Africa. It's lower there than the figure you heard, because this is overall all ages. It's not just women of reproductive age. And then Gauteng, where Johannesburg is, KwaZulu-Natal, Durban is the main city. And Gauteng is a middling prevalence rate for South African provinces. And then the Western Cape, where Cape Town is, has a relatively low prevalence for South Africa. So here is the map of Africa, and you can see South Africa down at the tip and the three countries. Cape Town, well, I can't, is on the coast, and so is Durban, but Johannesburg is in the interior. Here's a closer up of Western Cape, KwaZulu-Natal up on the edge, and Gauteng in the middle with Johannesburg. I'm just showing you who we interviewed so that you can get an idea of who was in the sample, what they, their characteristics. It's not, we didn't, since they were qualitative interviews, we didn't make any distinctions when in analyzing the data by these characteristics, but we had mostly nurses and some physicians. Most of the people were from public practice, and but a few in private. And the healthcare providers were from different racial backgrounds, but largely Black African. We also had some whites and Indians. And we included urban areas, peri-urban, and some rural areas, too, in our sample. The patient populations of these providers, according to the providers, were largely females of reproductive age and mostly Black Africans. The healthcare providers saw their patients as almost all of them at high risk of HIV. About half, according to the providers, of their patients have been HIV tested, and that's because a lot of the pregnant women are tested. And many, they see HIV positive results frequently among their patients. We use a semi-structured open question topic guide to ask the providers about their prevention practices with in-person interviews by trained interviewers from the Medical Research Council in Durban, who had recently been doing qualitative interviews of providers on microbicides. So they did a great job with our study. The interviews were about an hour long. We digital voice recorders were used, and then the healthcare facility was given a small gift for participation. We asked the providers about their pregnancy prevention practices, their HIV prevention practices, and we also asked them a lot about their role as a provider. What was their influence? What could they do for their patients? What couldn't they do for their patients? Where were they stuck? What did they feel proud of? And we analyzed the data. Oh, my goodness. That with ADMIS-TI, which is a qualitative software program, using deductive topic codes for the interview questions, and then also additional themes and conceptual codes were generated inductively from the data. The data were coded by three researchers, and responses were organized by theme. Now I will go to the results. And interestingly, a lot of what you heard from Sarah Newman in Kenya is what we heard from providers in South Africa, and it's a very different contraceptive context in South Africa with modern contraception widely available. But some of the things that Sarah said, I had to come down here to San Diego to find out. You said we work together. We're very much the case in South Africa, too. We asked the providers in the beginning, what were the reasons? What did they? Why did they see their patients getting pregnant when they didn't want to? And in South Africa, they referred to that as falling pregnant. And the providers talked a lot about fertility norms upheld by the male partner, even the in-laws, of childbearing, and also women being pressured or involuntary sex. And these were they noted that they saw unplanned pregnancy often, and they did discuss inconsistent use of contraception, but it wasn't the first or most obvious thing that came to mind when they were talking. So sometimes partners don't allow women to use contraception, and just because they want babies. And as some of these quotes say, the husband wants a kid now, or the mother-in-law wants a kid now. And the second quote, they fall pregnant because they want to keep the relationship, that is with the male partner. Or when they are in a relationship with a man, they say they find it difficult to say no when he wants sex. At times, they have protected sex, but the men complain. Providers also frequently brought up that teens become pregnant because they're young and not using contraception, scared to come to clinics, and have a low knowledge of contraception and pregnancy risks. These are very similar to the reasons we saw in the interviews we did of providers in the United States. So in this case, most people who are pregnant, they are 20 years and younger, so they will give a history of never having been on contraceptives. Or it's risk-taking because they're 15, it's the first time, and some of it's ignorance because they think that you have sex once and you can't fall pregnant. Well, that I feel like I've seen that quote a lot of times in a lot of different country contexts with young people. So the discontinuation of contraception was also mentioned by many of the providers. And in fact, in South Africa, with the injectable discontinuation rates, as I mentioned, are high. It's often due to side effects, and the most prevalent side effect discussed here were disturbances with menstrual patterns from injectables. Numerous providers talked about women who stopped the injectable because they wanted to have periods, and then they would get pregnant. These two quotes are from nurses at public community clinics in different regions of the country, Johannesburg and Western Cape. She's been on an injectable method for a long time, so the injectable method makes her have no periods, so she'll want to have periods because she feels that as a woman, she's supposed to have monthly periods. So she'll stop the injectables, not using anything else, and then falls pregnant. They stop, they say they want to see the blood comes, then there comes the baby. Several also mentioned missing pills and inaccessible clinics, but the focus really was on discontinuation due to menstrual changes. So what do the providers do for their patients? Hormonal contraception is available free of charge from the public sector in South Africa. And as I said, injectables and pills are used, but also some of the providers mentioned intrauterine contraception, the female condom, and sterilization. Many of the providers offer their patients hormonal methods for discreet use, for the woman to use without someone knowing. The emphasis, as Sarah Newman said in Kenya, is on the voluntary nature of contraception as a patient's choice. There was a lot of talk over and over about choice, and it's voluntary, and we give information, and they decide. We also found that all providers encourage condom use, and at the same time, they recognize that that rarely is a female patient choice that can be made. So, as noted before, these providers, too, talk about these choices within constrained contexts, and some choices aren't really choices when you get down to it. So one of the main things we saw from the providers was the support for discreet use of contraception. And The fertility and gender norms heighten the importance of methods that can be used privately by women. I know a lot of women, their husbands don't want them to use anything, so what I recommend to them is injections. The husbands don't need to know that they are actually using something. While most providers discussed injectables for discreet use, a few did mention intrauterine contraception. The copper T is available in the public sector in South Africa, but the levonorgestrel-releasing Mirena is not yet in the public sector, nor the single rod implant Implanon. There could be a large potential for use of these methods, however, particularly since updated WHO guidelines endorse the use of IUDs among HIV-infected women, and the implant gives superior effectiveness as well, with no action required for protection. And is also, the implant is recommended in high STI populations, as well as for HIV-infected and at-risk women. Counseling on bleeding pattern changes would have to be a high priority, and for some women, the copper T might be preferable so as not to miss the period, but for women with iron deficiency anemia, a levonorgestrel-releasing system would probably be a good choice. This quote is from an OBGYN when asked what he does for his patients who are having trouble staying on methods. And he says, I normally counsel them on methods that are going to be less compliance demanded, like intrauterine devices and injectables. Now, this is a highly trained specialist. And most women do not get their contraceptive care from OBGYNs. So, and this OBGYN wouldn't even have the implant. So, while some places in some pockets in South Africa, women might be able to get long-acting reversible contraception, it's certainly not available to all women. When asked about the promotion of dual method use, most providers did educate their patients on hormonal methods with condoms, unlike the findings from Kenya. Most providers said it was natural and easy, as well as inevitable, to give pregnancy and HIV prevention counseling at the same time, since the same patients will need education and supplies for both concerns. Injections, as well as condoms, especially to the HIV-positive ones, it's easy. In my consulting room, there's injectables as well as a condom box there. So you take a packet of condoms, and off you go. And this physician here said, I feel like those two cannot be separated, really. We saw from providers, every single provider emphasized condom use again and again. When asked about ABC, one physician in South Africa responded, CCC. That's the bottom one. Number one is condom, number two is condom, number three is condom. And the nurse on top says, even if they come in for a method, we emphasize dual protection. That is condoms, 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 all the time. So condom use isn't low in South Africa because the healthcare providers are ignoring condoms. They're working with patient populations and including trying to include male partners in this effort. What we did see is that a few providers educated patients to use. Some providers actually emphasize condoms, I think, over hormonal methods. And we saw that here in these quotes. We educated them mostly on condom use because it's dual protection, meaning pregnancy and STI, not meaning two methods. But if they are not willing, then we educate them on contraception plus abstinence. And the second one said, we recommend family planning methods, including condom use. We encourage condom use more than anything. So we did see in this high HIV context that there's a lot of focus on condoms, and sometimes maybe to the detriment of more effective methods of contraception for pregnancy prevention. So what happens in all this condom promotion to women who are pressured into sex? Well, providers had a whole array of approaches to use when women are pressured into sex. Rarely, only about 2 or 3 providers said they never saw a woman who had been pressured into sex. We've never met a case here in this clinic. Well, those providers, of course, had a much easier job, but most of the providers in the study talked about many things that they do all the time for their female patients. And the first thing that they said was to get the male partner in for education. I think they put a lot of hope on education, but also I just think it's not typical for men to be in the clinic setting, and they really try hard to get the men in. And one provider even mentioned that if the in-laws are the problem, then they invite in-laws to come in too. We always advocate in the clinic that people come in with their partners, because if the partner's here, then education will be fine. It won't be the woman alone who will be pressured by the partner. We want them to be together so that both of them will take the consequences of whatever is going to happen. Also, a lot of the providers talked about empowering women of the right to say no. And as down here we see, we empower them that their body is their body. So although fertility is within the context of the couple and then the larger family and the country, there is this individual approach with female clients to make their decisions and to try to help to support them to do that. Providers also offered services to women such as HIV testing or social workers if they needed more intensive help. Several providers also mentioned emergency contraception for cases of pressured sex, or also since men resist condoms and they resist women's use of contraception. In South Africa, emergency contraception is available at pharmacies, although expensive, in a levonorgestrel formulation or Levo. While women are becoming aware of it in rural areas, knowledge is low, and many of these providers see it as their mission to educate patients, particularly when they're talking about condom use. It was brought up a lot. The female condom is not widely used, but has been introduced in South Africa, and it was mentioned several times by the providers in this study, is what they tell women when the male partner won't use condoms. But the providers also were very frank about the low acceptability of not just male condoms, female condoms in their setting. But their enthusiasm, at least in these interviews, hasn't dampened. But it's obvious of a continuing need for female-controlled and discreet protection from HIV, since the pressure for sex always brings up HIV risk as well. The quote from above is from a nurse here trying to counsel a patient to use condoms, showing the futility in many cases. Female patients will always say, "He doesn't want it," meaning the condom. One lady, it came to push when I said, "With the other 2 kids that you have and this one that you're expecting, and you know you're HIV positive because of this man, don't you think of going home?" Because she stays in the squatter camp, these small rooms built for them around here. She said, "No, I cannot even tell them. They can't take the message home because they are relying on the man for support." And they also, the providers talked a lot about partner disclosure, and it was very difficult because the women come in for the testing when they're pregnant. And a lot of times the men haven't been tested, and the women are too scared to tell the men because they depend on them for support and for their children. So the providers saw that area of partner disclosure as very tricky. So the influence of the provider on the patient. Most providers talked about method preferences and choices coming from the patient, and the provider's role is information giving and to also to be attuned to health concerns. We heard over and over that they're there to give information. Some providers, however, did talk about the trust that patients have in a healthcare provider and their role is one of guidance. These providers are more likely to cite the relationships they have with the patients and to be talking about their larger life context. So all we can do is give information. It's up to the patient to make the decision. Method preferences, they decide on themselves. If they want to use injectables or a pill, unless there are contraindications, you can't force them to use a condom, but you insist on condom usage. So we saw these providers using a patient-tailored approach within very aware of their larger cultural and epidemiological context of high HIV, promoting condoms, that women can't necessarily show that they are using contraception. But I did want to caution that these results are limited to our providers in this purpose of sample. And currently, the data we've been collecting from the National Probability Survey should be able to give us a view of how practices might vary throughout the country and with different patient populations and risk levels. So, in conclusion, healthcare providers serving women in South Africa give evidence-based prevention care to a very vulnerable set of patients. They're aware of patient needs that might prevent continued use of contraception, are inventive in addressing these needs. But one of the areas they obviously need training and supplies to offer HIV-infected and at-risk women long-acting reversible contraception. Long-term contraception is important and an important HIV prevention tool through the prevention of unwanted pregnancy. And if used through sub-Saharan Africa, it could also help to improve maternal mortality. I think one other thing was with the disappointments on many fronts in the past few years of microbicides trials and the diaphragm trial and even the HIV vaccine, it's still a very big need for us to find different methods to offer female patients HIV protection in this heterosexual epidemic, particularly methods that are discreet. And so I leave that for future work. Thank you very much.
Any questions for clarification for that presentation, Doug?
Yeah. Thanks very much for the presentation. This is too sensitive, and I also applies to Sarah Newman. It's kind of a clarification, but it's a statement. I guess clarification. I think both of you should give more of the context of who these providers were. Let me give a cautionary tale. In your conclusion, you said that the providers give evidence of base prevention, informational prevention, and they're aware of the patient's needs. Well, perhaps. In a study we're doing in Ethiopia, there were a lot of providers who also collected information on the clients themselves. And there was quite a bit of dissonance between what the providers said they were doing and what they actually did. And when we explored how much time they spent counseling, some of them, at least, 2 minutes. And it wasn't that they were bad counselors. They had a tremendous caseload. So they knew some of the things that they were supposed to be doing.
That's
and so I think it sort of I sort of a little bit strong. I began to doubt taking alone information on provider perception of patients' needs, behavior, etc. I think it's much more important to learn providers' limitations in terms of their knowledge, etc. But I think that asking them to project what they feel patients do and need, etc., with the small number that you're dealing with and with the techniques that are employed, is actually, I'll put it out there, questionable value.
Yeah, thank you. I agree that when you ask somebody something, they're going to give you the answer that you're looking for. And we try to keep focused on provider practices and not on what they thought the patient needed or what the patient thought, but what the provider was doing with patients. And we included patient scenarios, vignettes, which have been shown in other research to be as effective as having an observer in the room. Now, I'm not sure if that's always the case, but we did give them patient scenarios, and then they had to choose what they were doing for that patient. And when we analyze our survey data, we'll be able to see that. And I also know from other research that I've been doing on providers that there are a lot of areas and practices that need attention. So I appreciate that. Here we were trying to point more to the places that providers got to where they couldn't go any further or what was their challenge. It was a little different. I've been doing some research in the United States showing how provider practices aren't necessarily evidence-based. But this is our impetus here was a little bit different, seeing what's needed in Africa. How are the providers feeling? But thank you.
I wonder if maybe we could go back to your question about PEPFAR, since we put you off until the general discussion and we don't have much more time.
If anybody in the audience is more familiar or works for an agency which actually receives PEPFAR funding, please feel free to stand up. But my understanding, that PMTCT is a very important part of PEPFAR goals.
Do any of the panelists, or anyone else in the audience, know the effect of ART on reducing
So the question was about the impact of ARTs on reducing vertical transmission, mother-to-child transmission. The answer is it depends. It depends on whether you're talking about transmission through breastfeeding or through birth itself. And I wish that I had these data at my fingertips. What I can tell you is that in the U.S., where you have C-sections, where you have nevirapine during delivery, and where you have no breastfeeding, transmission rates can be reduced down to about 2-3%. HIV positive women who do not breastfeed their infants, who deliver via cesarean section.
Who don't deliver, who have typical delivery and aren't delivered by cesarean section and breastfeed their babies anyway.
Oh, for breastfeeding. And are taking ARTs. I don't have those data at my fingertips. I know that there have been conflicting results. I know that there have been that it's been shown that it can dramatically reduce vertical transmission, but unfortunately, I wish I had. Thank you. I knew that somebody in this room knew that. Thank you.
We know from our experience in San Francisco General and elsewhere that we completely eliminate vertical transmission.
Right.
We do what we're supposed to do. Thank you.
The other, of course, getting back to your earlier question, is that the family planning, the reducing unintended pregnancy pillar of PMTCT is woefully neglected in programming, in AIDS programming, including in PEPFAR programming. So that alone would make a huge difference, yeah. Other questions? Yes. I saw two more hands. We'll take two more questions and then we'll finish. Yes.
Would you say at the policy level, I think that is there anyone working to try to say, you know, if there's a change, when there's a change in administration, which there clearly will be, whichever way it goes, what's the recommendation on the continuum between family planning, HIV, and maternal health? And whether or not there's a real, like, effort to try to say this is an integrated set of services that should be moved forward, and who's leading that policy charge, and how much is that traction?
Duff, that sounds like something you might be able to answer. We wish, right?
Yes. I'm not sure if you mean moving reproductive health and maternal health closer together.
And HIV.
And HIV? Highly unlikely. Yeah. I mean, what's happened even within the HIV/AIDS community is that you now have treatment and care interest groups battling prevention interest groups, and I mean, I'm not saying it's not going to happen, but I think it'd be a challenge.
And just another bit of advertising, Duff and I are going to be in a session on Wednesday morning on family planning on the development agenda, so if you're interested, please come to that. Dan, last question.
I just had a question for Sarah. You both kind of talked about very medicalized models of distributing family planning in a clinic setting, and I understand that both in Kenya and South Africa there's sort of been a swing away from community-based distribution networks. I was wondering if you could say anything about using community health workers to provide family planning.
No, but I mean, in Kenya, there has been a long history of community-based distribution of contraception, but it is the Ministry of Health won't let community-based health workers distribute anything other than condoms and pills. And over the years, that has fallen by the wayside, it seems, primarily because the incentive program to the community healthcare workers has waned, and so it's really hard for people to keep up their enthusiasm about providing community-based contraception when they're not getting anything in return. And that's something that the family planning community is really trying to revitalize, but there is some tension between the people who want to provide and the Kenyan government, because there's a limit as to what people can provide and how they're reimbursed. But there is, and I'm not remembering, but there is somebody now who is doing a pilot study in Kenya with community-based healthcare workers distributing Depo-Provera. And so hopefully, if they can show that it's feasible and it works, that there can be some policy change on the Ministry of Health level.
Yeah, I know, we're ending now, yes. All right, we have one more person at the back of the room who needs to... Okay. Great. Thank you. Thank to all of our panelists, and thank you for a great discussion.
It hasn't actually even been defined by
by the government. So it's called Family Planning into HIV Care. Family Planning into Voluntary Health and Testing has their guidelines around that and also their strategic plan. And so they're really using that to model the integration of HIV care. So I really think it's very close.
Hi, I
came from Nairobi. I was in Nairobi doing something different. Do you work there as well?
I do. You know Bob Bailey?
I know Bob Bailey, but I've never met him.
What's in here?
Thank you.
Good.
Oh,